It's Arcadataology.
Arcahula, what a G?
Right. Arcadataology. Data before it knew it was data.
What do you got?
I have cuneiform clay tablets from Mesopotamia, about 4,000 years old.
It looks like wet cement after some pigeons walked all over it.
Yeah, that may be, but those pigeon prints are some of the earliest known writing, and most of these tablets are actually data.
Oh yeah, the original Excel files. Where's the undo button?
Well, if you discovered your mistake quickly enough, you could use a rolling pin or press on a little piece of wet clay.
Ancient liquid paper.
Yeah. I'm not sure how many of our listeners know what that is.
Oh, perhaps not. But if you used a typewriter regularly, you know.
Typewriter. That's another good ancient artifact.
Well, maybe we'll dig one of those up sometime. Hey, did you ever press a bunch of keys at the same time to jam up the type bars?
And they go, kerchunk. Yes, I did.
And then have to flip them back into place one at a time until the logjam broke.
All right, focus. Back to Mesopotamia.
Okay.
Once written, important records got baked in kilns to make them permanent, but we believe that most were left unfired to be recycled.
Immutable records. No version control issues.
No updates either.
Hey, boss, I fixed the revenue numbers. Great, just smash the report and start all over.
You joke, but most tablets, or at least those that have survived, were transaction records. Who owned what, how much, and when.
So, accounting. Humanity invents writing and immediately uses it for invoices. Data at the dawn of civilization.
That's not surprising. Data enables civilization to scale beyond the limits of memory. It's less a byproduct and more a co-requisite once societies got complex.
So the first data warehouse was a warehouse.
Literally. Shelves of tablets, all indexed and categorized.
And queried by Dave, the scribe. Hey, Dave, run me a report on the barley shipments. Okay, give me 3 weeks and a chisel.
Yeah, pretty much. It's the foundation of analytics, turning raw transaction into recorded knowledge.
BI version 0.0.
So imagine presenting a report to your boss. Hey, the quarterly results are in, sir. He said, hefting a 50-pound stack of tablets.
I once accidentally printed out a large mainframe report that was 10 pounds of green bar paper.
Ah, green bar paper. Another good artifact idea.
Yeah. So these tablets were trustworthy. No silent edits, no corrupted files. Unless, of course, someone dropped the tablet, you know, and shattered it.
Unfortunately, glue had been invented tens of thousands of years earlier.
And the problems are the same today as they were then. Capture data, store it, trust it, use it.
And somewhere, 4,000 years ago, a manager is still asking, can I get that by the end of the day?
I hadn't thought about it quite that way before.
Well, now you have.
Hey, I wonder if they ever cut holes into the ends and linked them together with ropes.
Not that I know of. Why?
Because that would have been the first blockchain.
Cute.
This is John Ladley
and Mark Cooper.
Welcome to the Rock Bottom Data Feed.
Hey, John.
Yeah?
Something you said in your monologue last time really stuck in my head.
It did?
Yeah. You mentioned that governance is embedded into the cockpit of a commercial airliner, that there are procedures and checklists and cross-checking, but there isn't a governance committee looking over the pilot's shoulders, making sure that they do everything.
Well, they do. Once or twice a year, either in a simulator or someone watching over their shoulder from a jump seat, there is somebody that occasionally observes.
Yeah, but not day to day.
Correct. Not day to day.
So I got thinking about why that is and why it works and what's different about data.
Well, why don't you take the monologue then? I'll meet with you on the other side with the first part of our conversation with John Padfield. John is a technology and privacy advocate, has a monstrous YouTube channel, and he'll be discussing surveillance, data, and civil liberties.
You'll think twice before clicking accept on a software license agreement after hearing from him.
I'm not sure we can be paranoid enough. We also have another data poetry slam And of course, the 8-Bit Consultant. It's a very full show.
Then I'll get it going. John said something in his monologue in our last episode I'd like to dig into a little deeper. Go back and listen to the show, where he talked about how governance is embedded in the cockpit of a commercial airliner. Procedures, checklists, and cross-validation, and it all happens without anybody watching over their shoulders. It seems the exact opposite is true when it comes to corporate data. Governance almost never happens without constant oversight. So I got to thinking, why would it be pervasive in one setting and absent in the other? Well, for one thing, in the cockpit, there is a bright straight line between the failure to do appropriate governance and potentially fatal consequences. They say that aviation regulations are written in blood because most every safety rule and checklist procedure was created in response to an accident where someone died or was severely injured. When I was in high school, I watched an HBO documentary about the 1942 fire at the Coconut Grove nightclub. It made a big impression on me. To this day, I still notice the swinging doors that flank revolving doors and panic bars and stuff like that. Bright, straight lines between governance and consequence. Interestingly, many of the regulations broadly mandated as a result of the fire were proposed and in some cases locally enacted following earlier tragedies, including one that killed 209 just 2 years earlier. Regrettably, it took the deaths of 492 more people to create a shared, undeniable narrative that enabled reforms to be both codified and widely adopted. So how does this all apply to data? Data is living in the pre-Coconut Grove era of fire safety. It's 1941. Lots of signals, no collective urgency, and we haven't yet experienced that painful turning point event. It's hard because the connection between data and a problem is usually less apparent and less immediate. We have no shared narrative that says, this is what bad data does. Instead of a unifying moment, we get localized fixes, industry-specific regulations, and continued skepticism about whether data governance is really necessary. Neither the benefits nor the consequences are well understood, and so they need to be made visible so that they can be internalized by everyone. So start treating data-related incidents like accident investigations. Every missed deadline, bad decision, broken dashboard, or failed model. Identify the root causes, measure the impact, recommend changes, understand those incidents, and learn from them. And one more thing, be nice to each other.
Our guest today, and we are really pleased as punch to have him here, is Dr. John Padfield. He has a YouTube channel that is very popular called the Business Reform Channel. Dr. Padfield, welcome to the Rock Bottom Data Feed.
Pleasure to be with you today. I look forward to our conversation. Well, if I could start with one of my biggest pet peeves with industry in general today, this is seen most often with big data brokers. And we could even get into a lengthy discussion about what exactly is a data broker, because there are narrower definitions and there are broader definitions. But data brokers are people that collect your data. They may collect it directly through some data feed that they are getting from you. I'll use General Motors as an example. General Motors is being sued by the state of Texas because they have been gathering data on millions of Texas drivers. And there is controversy about whether those drivers gave their consent. According to General Motors, yes, they all gave their consent. According to the people who gave their consent, I don't know what you're talking about. And so it really comes down to what's known in academia as informed consent. As a professor, if I'm going to go out and do research, I must submit a proposal. If this research is going to involve human subjects, and that doesn't mean, you know, injecting them with things, research on human subjects includes doing a survey. If I want to take a survey, I have to go before the Institutional Review Board, the IRB. IRBs were created by Congress in 1972 as a result of some experiments that were done. The Stanford Prison Experiment was one of those. But university research was getting abusive. And Congress intervened and said, from now on, If a university is going to do research, it must be approved by an institutional review board who will review it for ethical standards. And I used to be able to quote the exact U.S. code from from memory, but there are 8 parts to what's called informed consent. This is kind of a ridiculous example, but imagine if I just said, John, would you be willing to take part in a survey? And you say, sure. And then I kick you really hard and I give you a survey that says, how much did that hurt? Well, you gave your consent. You said you were willing to take part in the survey, but I didn't fill you in on the possible harm that could come from it. Kind of a silly example, but the idea.
No, you've also described marriage, so that covered a lot of ground.
The idea of informed consent is you must fill this person in on potential harms. Imagine you've been through some traumatic experience, and I start poking and prodding about, tell me about this, tell me about how you felt when that happened to you, and all of a sudden you're being overwhelmed with some really depressing memories from 20 years ago. And then I just walk away and leave you depressed because I've opened some old wounds. So the Institutional Review Board, they require researchers to do what's called informed consent. And it's not just saying, do you agree to take part in this survey? There are 8 elements to informed consent. And I would like to see that level of scrutiny, or at least something approaching that level of scrutiny, rather than just a click here that you agree to our terms of service, that you need a law degree to even understand. So this is why General Motors is in hot water right now with the state of Texas. GM is saying people consented to this, but people had no idea you're collecting all of this detailed data about my driving habits. How often do I drive after 10 p.m.? How hard do I hit the brakes? How often do I speed? And then you're selling this information to insurance companies, and my rates are going up or my policy's getting canceled. People did not know this was going to happen when GM claims they consented. In addition, Attorney General Ken Paxton in Texas, I read the complaint that he filed. It's about a 20-page complaint to the court. One of the things that he claims is he has copies of training material General Motors gave to salespeople, basically telling them how to trick people into consenting. One of the things that they recommend is when you buy a car, you sit down in the driver's seat. The salesman that you just bought the car from sits down in the passenger seat, and he will help you register. So things come up on screen, and he will sit there and tap the I agree, so that you can get on your way in 5 minutes rather than you taking time to read everything that the salesperson just helped you agree to.
Sounds like buying a timeshare.
Yes. Oh, perfect example. I forgot all about timeshares, but they would definitely fall under this. So the idea is we really do need informed consent. On top of that, once somebody starts collecting your data, what they do with that data is bad enough. One of my biggest pet peeves is their lack of accountability. There's a company that was responsible for something like 3 billion records being released. Public Data, I believe, was the name of the company. But they suffered a data breach. They did not even encrypt all the data they had. So literally every person in the United States had their social security number and other key information leaked on the dark web because they didn't even bother to encrypt the data that they had collected on so many people. That drives me nuts. In my opinion, that is criminal negligence. You collected all of this data, put it in one spot, you know that you're going to be a target, and you don't even take care to make sure that that data stays secure. Doing even the minimal thing like encrypting it, and then that data gets stolen. Well, hey, not my problem. You might want to sign up for some credit monitoring service for the next couple of years. But when you think about 300 million people having their social security number leaked, if they have to go out and start checking their credit reports to make sure that no one's opening accounts in their name because everything you need for identity theft was just stolen, think about the millions or billions of man hours that are going to be lost. And this company just kind of wipes their hands and walks away. I think people ought to be going to prison for that.
In the early days, you know, some of the early data breaches, you know, the Target one being the most famous, of course, but, you know, those made front page news and everybody was all, you know, I don't want to. Yeah. But now I look at data breaches almost like car alarms. You know, you get one of those letters in the mail once a month, once every other month, a couple of weeks, whatever. Another data breach. There's another 6 months of credit monitoring. Okay. You know, it goes on the pile with everything else. And I think folks have largely numb to it.
That is an excellent analogy, the car alarms. I remember many years ago when car alarms first started and you hear a car alarm and everyone's looking for, you know, where's the thief? And today, so common, nobody even looks.
It's in fact, it becomes an annoyance.
Yep.
And I think the letters end up being the same way. Borland, I think it was very proud of their license agreements back in the 80s and 90s. Their one page and had a big letter, our one page license agreement. And, you know, there it was. But I've only ever known one person that read them. And not surprisingly, she was in data protection and would frequently not sign up to websites or not buy software as a result of terms in that. Only person I've ever known who did that. Mm-hmm. Maybe I know two now.
So corporations are obviously in new territory here. Mark, you and I were talking about that before we got really going here this morning. And you had a really good metaphor for where companies need to go on here.
Corporate data, I think, needs to be like the Autobot. Another metaphor there. And you need to be able to move as quickly as possible, as fast as possible, as long as you're on the road. But you have to have guardrails so that you don't drive someplace that you're not supposed to. And so I'm curious from your perspective, how can utilization and value be accelerated? But also, what do you see as the missing guardrails? You know, we know the guardrails, the PII guardrails and those types of guardrails. I think those go at this point, maybe even if not without saying, but mostly without saying.
Well, yeah, there's enormous amounts of regulation already. What else do we need?
Excellent questions from both of you. Let me start by addressing the Autobahn analogy, which is a good one. There is a similar analogy that I read many years ago in a completely different context. It wasn't related to data. It was related to some other advances in technology. But the author of the book, I believe it was James Reason, who wrote a book about failures, he said technology is progressing at an exponential rate. And I agree. He said our ability to anticipate unintended consequences is accelerating at a linear rate. I also agree. And he used this great analogy. If my speed is going up exponentially, but my ability to anticipate unintended consequences is going up linear, we have this increasing gap of something bad's going to happen that we never saw coming. And he used the analogy of driving in the fog with your headlights. You know, if I'm driving down a county road, there's no street lights, and all I can see is what's illuminated by my headlights. On a clear night, no fog, you know, I can safely run 55 mile an hour under most circumstances. But when the fog starts coming in, my visibility drops because my headlights don't light up as far in advance. I need to slow down. And you know, especially you get into a winter whiteout condition where there's so much snow falling, you can only see 30 feet in front of your bumper. You really, really have to slow down. But what we're seeing in society is technology is making us do 110, and we're still using 1980s headlights that let us see, you know, 150 feet in front of us when we're doing 110 mile an hour. Now, when something goes wrong, we're in the middle of it before we have any chance to hit the brakes or do anything else because technology is moving so much faster than we can see the unintended consequences coming. So that's my first thought about the analogy. When it comes to transparency, there's a couple of things going on. Or excuse me, when it comes to the guardrails, a couple of things. This is something that I really stress in my data analytics class. And this is an intro to data analytics. And when I was asked to develop the class, I told my department head the first third of this class is going to be on data ethics. Because I said, I do not want to show someone how to use a tool before I cover how to do it ethically. And so we spend the first couple of weeks in class talking about data ethics. And one of the big issues that I see, yes, we're on the same page here. Data collected for one purpose is often used for other purposes later down the road. And there's an example. This is a very old example, but it's kind of a cautionary tale. Let's go back to the beginning of World War II, and it was U.S. policy, if you are of Japanese ancestry, you're going to be rounded up and put into an internment camp. It's less known, but the U.S. government did that to people of German ancestry and people of Italian ancestry as well. Here's the question. When the president gave that order back during World War II and the army went out and started rounding up Americans of a certain ethnic descent, how did they know where to go get them? For decades, people accused the U.S. Census Bureau of sharing data. And for decades, the U.S. Census Bureau denied it. And then around 2003, somebody digging through the National Archives found the smoking gun. Yes, the U.S. Census Bureau did share data about where people of Japanese and German ancestry were living. Oh, yeah, we forgot about that. You lied to us for over 50 years. And eventually, when the smoking gun was found that, yes, people filled out their census forms, and it's all over the census forms. This data is only used for census purposes. It is never shared with any other government agency. You lied.
Right.
Yep. And so, you know, given that, how many other pieces of government information have we provided that have been used in a way beyond what was stated? I have no idea. It's one of those things when you catch one lie, you have to ask how many other lies have I been told that I haven't proven yet, but it would be naive to think, oh, glad that only happened once. No, once that we know of, countless times that we don't know of. So that's the first principle. Data submitted for one purpose is often used for other purposes. I use this example in class also. There is an app called Strava, S-T-R-A-V-A, and runners and bicyclists are very familiar with it. It is an exercise app. And if you have a smartwatch or something like that, you can upload your workouts to Strava. It's cloud-based. But you can see I used to take, you know, 8 minutes to run a mile. Now I can do it in 7.5. Obviously not me personally, but for athletes. I'm a cyclist, and so I use Strava for recording my bicycle rides. Strava is collecting data from literally millions of people around the world. And back around, I think it was 2018, 2019, they had a bright idea. We're going to make this totally anonymous. We're not going to tie anyone's ID to where they run or where they bicycle, but we're going to publish this global heat map showing all the trails that people run and showing all the routes that people ride their bikes. And we're going to publish this online. Sounds like a great idea with the best of intentions. What could possibly go wrong? As soon as they publish that, again, totally anonymous, you have no idea who ran this trail or who rode their bike on this particular route. But as soon as they published this global heat map, people started looking through it because you could zoom in just like you could with a world map. And they started seeing about 15 miles southeast of Baghdad, people are out here running this route out in the middle of the desert in what used to be a secret military base. I say used to be because it's now out there for anyone to go look up.
Oops.
And a number of covert military bases, some U.S., some British, but they're being discovered because soldiers violated policy and used an app to track their workouts. But now that data has been published, and again, Strava was not being malicious. Strava just thought, hey, this is really cool. We have trillions of data points of where people run, where people ride their bikes. Let's just publish it because this is cool. They never thought about this might divulge national secrets.
Yeah, I mean, this is the whole unintended consequences. And this is why I go back to the Industrial Revolution, because it was like, wow, we're going to, instead of one dude making a doily a day, I can make 10 million doilies a day, and we can be rich making doilies with our steam engines and stuff. And then we said, yeah, but all these workers don't have a place to go to the bathroom. I mean, you know, we have cholera and typhus, and we have those. I don't think we're going to get diseases out of this, but, you know, something, we have these unintended consequences. So one thing I'm going to kind of pick apart your response here, because for the corporation, and where Mark and I and a lot of our listeners live, is the people that are actually on the front line doing this work, sitting down typing, the analysts, the database administrators, and things like that. So what I'm hearing, one thing is slow down, is mm-hmm. what I heard. One thing is, that's a guardrail. The other guardrail is ethics. And we've had a very good author on ethics. We had Dara O'Brien, Dr. Catherine O'Keefe, they're from the EU, and they wrote a book on ethics, because the EU is way ahead of us on codifying data behaviors and things like that. So before we move on to the next thing, what other guardrail? If I'm a CEO, all right, and you've got me in the elevator for about 30 seconds here, John. All right. I got ethics. I got slow down. Give me two other things that a CEO, you know, CEOs are busy and they really don't have time, and they make you feel pretty stupid when they leave the elevator anyway. But, you know, what else would you tell them? You've got this, you know, you've got 15 seconds here. This is your big chance. All right. So what else would you say?
Hand in hand with the ethics is the transparency. People do not understand what's being done with their data. And this is going to exceed that 30 seconds to the CEO, but I just want to share a very recent example.
Okay.
A woman I know that lives in Chicago, she posted this on LinkedIn. I've had conversations with her in the past. She and her husband went to a very upscale restaurant, and when they were seated, the manager of the restaurant came over and said, "Oh, my favorite VIPs." And she said, "What do you mean by that?" And he said the quiet part out loud. He stepped over to the cash register, printed out about a 6-inch piece from the cash register, and brought it back and showed her her name, her husband's name. It said VIP on it. It showed what they typically order, how much they normally spend. And she was shocked. They were categorized as big spenders. That was their category on this receipt that this manager showed her. And she was appalled. They knew the name because this is an upscale restaurant and they would call in and make reservations. So I know your name. I know your credit card number. You've been here multiple times. And it listed, you know, they're a frequent visitor and they're big spenders because they order appetizers, they order alcohol, they order dessert. And she said, this horrified me because this labeled me as a big spender. And she is very concerned about surveillance pricing. I don't want to walk into Kroger and get charged 20% extra for a can of beans because I've been labeled as a big spender and they know I can afford it. And the surveillance pricing is probably one of the most important issues right now, because that directly impacts consumers. So much of what you and I talk about, so much of what we focus our attention on, is important, but it's not visible. The average person says, so what? So somebody tracks what I watch on TV. So somebody tracks what I look at on the internet. Why should I care? Well, you should care because it make that can of beans cost 30 cents extra the next time you go to the grocery store.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, this is really broad is what I'm getting from this here. And I mean, we've used a lot of analogies and we have a lot of stories. This is really broad. So let's get towards what to do. What can we do as people? What can institutions do? Things like that. So I'm going to just throw out some crazy stuff here. Mm-hmm. All right. Should we change the Fourth Amendment? should we have a new amendment at a societal, national, government level for this? Should at a national level, should we codify what data behavior should be? Which is, as I think all three of us would agree, that would be quite the session of writing that legislation. Would be fascinating to be a fly on the wall in that room. But details aside, is that where we need to go as a society, to that level?
I am a huge fan of the Fourth Amendment. The here's the biggest shortcoming in the entire Constitution, in my opinion. Let's go back and look at when the Constitution was written, 1781, when the Constitutional Convention was held. It was sent out to the states, 12 states. 12 states sent representatives to the Constitutional Convention. When it was crafted and sent out to the states, all 13 states ratified it. But that was written in 1781. We're talking almost 250 years ago. The Constitution applies to the government. Now, we have the federal constitution. Each state has their own state constitution. But what is missing from those constitutions is regulation on any type of corporation. I talk about this in some of my other business classes outside of data analytics. Businesses go back to biblical times. There were people making tents and musical instruments way, way back in the Old Testament. Corporations are relatively new. And I'm not saying they're brand new, but compared to businesses, corporations are new. And they served a very important purpose. Putting railroads across the United States, no family-owned business had the money to do that. It took a new form of business, a corporation where multiple investors pooled their money to do something huge like putting railroads across the United States back in the 1800s. But I don't think anyone at the Constitutional Convention ever foresaw where things are going to be today. I did this study about a year and a half ago. I looked at the top six U.S. corporations by market cap. At that time, it was Tesla, Apple, Microsoft, Google, Meta. But I just looked at what is the market cap of the top six most valuable companies in the United States. And then I started looking at what is the GDP of South America. The top six U.S. countries are worth more than the GDP of South America. And North America, if you exclude the United States and Canada. That still leaves a lot in North America, even taking those out. And about half of Africa and Russia. So when you look at the top six most valuable companies in the United States, about half of Africa, Russia, South America, and all of North America, except the U.S. and Canada. That's what those six companies are worth. And I don't think anyone during the Constitutional Convention ever foresaw corporations having that type of power. So let's translate that on the data side when it comes to something like the Fourth Amendment. There is a company called Fog Data Science. You can go out and look up their website right now, fogdatascience.com. What they are doing is they are buying people's location history because we all carry our trackers with us. There are apps on our phones that are recording our location, and Fog Data Science buys that from all of these apps, weather apps, you name it. They compile it, and then they sell a subscription service to law enforcement. So if I were a police officer and I had a subscription, John, I could just put in your phone number and I could see to within a couple of feet everywhere that you've been for the last 3 years. Beyond that, I could see that you went to this park and you sat on a bench with Mark and you sat there for 35 minutes. Who's Mark? Let's follow him. Now, it's not going to tell me this is Mark, but it's going to give me his number and I can follow him back to his house and I can see who he's talking to. Think about a journalist that has whistleblowers going to a journalist. Well, just put in that journalist's phone number and you can see every person that they have been in close proximity to. The whole point is that doesn't take a warrant because that's public information because a private company has it. And they're selling subscriptions to this information to law enforcement. Now let's go back to the Fourth Amendment. police cannot do a search without a warrant. You know, there are some stipulations there. This has been to the Supreme Court for interpretation. But the idea was, the assumption was, law enforcement would be surveilling people who were suspects. I don't think that the founders ever had an idea that a private company is going to have this type of information they could make available to law enforcement. Flock Safety is doing this with license plate readers around the country. But over and over and over, we're seeing a level of intrusion into our personal lives because all of us are leaking data constantly. What websites do you visit? What do you watch on television? All of that data is being collected, it's being compiled, and it's being served up without warrants. And that is that level of transparency. So, yes, I absolutely think that there needs to be a federal standard saying we need to put some brakes on this because nobody has a shred of privacy left when this is running unchecked. Part of what I do on my channel is try to inform people of ways that they can reduce the amount of data that's being fed into this system. But it's a matter of reducing the data. You can't turn it off.
Tune in next time for the second half of our conversation with John Padfield. For irreverent yet practical data content, you are in the right place here at the Rock Bottom Data Feed. But there's only so much we can cover in each show. To learn about everything else data, there's Dataversity. They have the broadest coverage, deepest experience, and the best content creators. And if you use discount code ROCK15, you can get 15% off your first purchase. Check them out at dataversity.net. Dispatches from Rock Bottom, dredging up practical information, advice, and food for thought. Take it, John.
As we are recording this in April of 2026, the latest round of AI-related layoffs is Snap, laying off about 1,000 employees. According to their press release, this decision is primarily attributed to the advancements in AI and the need to streamline operations. This is another in a series of notable layoffs. Other companies and their reasons are Salesforce, 4,000 for shifting towards AI-driven customer interactions, 30,000 at Amazon, streamlining operations with AI, IBM, 4,000 to 6,000, initiatives of AI aimed at cost reduction, and Oracle, 30,000 people, freeing up cash for AI. The conversations about a double-edged sword here have started. Mark Andreessen says AI layoffs are a farce. Companies are 75% overstaffed, and AI is the silver bullet excuse to clean house. Other sources are saying AI is not generating expected productivity and relate that layoff now thinking in corporate America rarely reduces workforce from new technology. Many observe that time and time again in human history, labor is reallocated, like in the steam engine, automobiles, robotic assembly. No one makes buggy whips anymore, but car mechanics are paid better. Not fewer jobs, but different jobs. The integration of AI is shaping the job market, at least for now, leading to layoffs as companies seek to be quote-unquote more efficient. The trend is expected to continue at least for a while. However, again, history has shown that the longer term we get a talent crisis, we rarely increase value, and there are new jobs that pop up. Is AI deja vu all over again? Layoffs save money, fail to increase value, companies don't fess up, cover up their mistakes, long-term damage is done, we create new jobs. Or maybe AI is different. Time will tell.
That's what we think. We'd love to hear your stories if you're willing to share. Write us at rockbottom@counterthreadedproductions.com. Poetry Slam. There once was a wheel from Dimbach. Exec said, well, this is just a crock. More consoles, more decks, who actually checks? So the dashboards they quietly all mocked. There once was a wheel from Dimbach. Exec said, seems nothing but tech talk. More slides, someone groaned, we need stuff people own. So out of the meeting, they all walked. There once was a wheel from Dimbach. To execs, it was nothing but gridlock. Don't show them, we pled. Change your culture instead. So two data products, they all flocked. We still use the wheel from Dimbach. With data products, more value we unlock. We've owners in place and trusted its base. Now AI can scale without shock. Data Poetry Slam.
The 8-Bit Consultants. Advice in 256 characters or less. 4 times better than those 2-bit consultants. Today's question is for Mark. When does a data set become a data product? Is there a ceremony or a proclamation? I created the data set according to your requirements. You don't have to summarize it yourself. You're using the results to run the business. Sounds like a data product to me.
It could be, but data product isn't just new branding. The data itself is one piece, but it also has clear definitions, quality standards, active support processes, and durable ownership. The product in data product isn't the data, it's reliability.
The 8-Bit Consultants.
If you have a question in 256 characters or less, leave a comment or write us at rockbottom@counterthreadedproductions.com.
This broadcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered legal advice. Counterthreaded is not responsible for any losses, damages, or liabilities that might arise from the use of this podcast. The views expressed in this podcast may not be those of the host or the management. This podcast is not intended to replace professional medical advice.
John Padfield brought to our attention the ways that companies collect and use our data that we don't often think about, fully understand, or knowingly agree to. He shared some eye-opening examples, from cars tracking driver behavior to brokers selling incredibly detailed personal information with little accountability. Data collected for one purpose can end up being used in completely different ways. Along the way, made the case that we need better transparency, stronger guardrails, and a serious rethink about how data is governed today. And speaking of governing data, be sure to visit dataversity.net and use discount code ROCK15 to get 15% off your first purchase. Until next time, this has been John Ladley and Mark Cooper for the Rock Bottom Data Feed. Thanks for listening, and remember, when you're here, you've reached rock bottom. You can find more information about the topics covered in this episode, the fuss about John Padfield, at our website, rockbottomdatafeed.com. The Rock Bottom Data Feed is a Counter-Threaded production, copyright 2026, all rights reserved.